The Angie's List you know and trust is now Angie, and we're so much more than just a list. We still connect you with top local pros and show you ratings and reviews, but now we also let you compare upfront prices on hundreds of projects and book a service instantly. We can even handle the rest of your project from start to finish. So remember, Angie's List is now Angie, and we're here to get your job done right. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I, or download the app today.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
The Incomparable, number 643, December 2022.
Welcome back to The Incomparable. I'm Jean McDonald, filling in for Jason Snell, and I'm excited for my chance to be sitting in the captain's chair for this, a look back at the unforgettable film The Poseidon Adventure, which celebrates its 50th anniversary this year. Like producer Irwin Allen, I too have assembled an all-star cast for this episode. And starting with Annette Weirstra. Hey, Annette.
Hey, Jean. I'm here in a very nice long gown with a convenient pair of shorts underneath.
Excellent. Steve Lutz, what about you?
Oh, I'm just wearing panties under this. I should have put on something decent like my husband told me.
And I couldn't do this without Shelley Brisbane, our resident classic film star expert, and if you know the Poseidon Adventure and this genre generally, that is a good background to have. Hey, Shelley.
Hello. In the water, I'm a very skinny lady.
And finally, you can't run a ship without a chief engineer, so I've recruited a special, very special guest, John Chidji, the host of the podcast Causality. John, welcome to The Incomparable.
Thanks for inviting me, Gene. It's a pleasure to be here. And I'm not going to describe what I'm wearing, but let's just say I will have to change if I'm going to go into the office later.
Well, that sounds great. And so, as I mentioned, we're here to talk about this legendary disaster film, The Poseidon Adventure, which opened on December 12th, 1972, nearly 25 years ago. As we record that, 50 years ago, as we record that. Sorry,
I got myself confused, doesn't it?
I got myself confused because I realized as I was preparing today that it's exactly 25 years between the release of the Poseidon Adventure and the release of Titanic, and it's 25 years since the Titanic. So this is a big anniversary year. It was one of the biggest box office. It was the biggest box office success in 1973, and also one of the biggest releases ever on the small screen when the television rights were acquired by ABC. So before we talk about the film in detail, I'd really love to hear a little bit more about from y'all when you first saw it and where or how old you were, because I have a story, but I want to hear yours first. Let's start with you, Annette.
I don't remember exactly when I've seen it. I've seen it once before. I'm going to say in the last 20 years, post Titanic. And I loved it. I was like, this is an amazing film in terms of disaster film and action. But when I went back to watch it again, I remembered the upside down part, spoilers. And I remembered the ballroom, and I remembered kind of key points, but I kind of forgot who makes it, who doesn't make it, the key. So it was kind of like going into a movie I knew I liked, but watching it for the first time all over again.
Oh, cool.
Which was fun.
That's cool. That's a great perspective. How about you, Steve? When did you first see this?
I first saw this when I was either 7 or 8 years old. And I know that because some of you are probably aware that when I was younger, I did a little bit of child acting. And I was in a TV show called Skinflint, A Country Christmas Carol in 1979. And when that was about to be aired, my dad went out and bought one of the early VCRs that's basically the size and shape of a boat anchor. So thematically appropriate for this podcast. But in addition to purchasing the VCR, he also picked up a movie. And this was at the time when you would go out to buy a movie, it cost you but somewhere between $80 and $100 because they very jealously guarded, you know, movies at the time. You can just go out and buy a $5 DVD. So, you know, it must have cost some amount of money. But for a very long time, that was the only VHS tape that we had. So I must have watched the Poseidon Adventure 30, 40 times when I was a kid. And it's funny watching now because it's probably been 25, 30 years since I've seen it. Mm-hmm. And the fine details, I certainly don't remember, but I still, when I'll hear a line of dialogue, I'll know exactly which one is coming next and in what tone of voice it's about to be spoken. Is so deeply ingrained is it in my psyche from having watched it so much as a kid.
Wow. Shelley, what do you remember?
I saw it in the theater when I was a real little kid. I don't know if it was probably when it was re-released because it was released in late 72 and then they did a re-release in 74, I think, or 73 because it was really so popular, as you said. And my mom and I used to go to movies and I had finally reached, well, I hadn't really reached the age where you could take kids to adult movies, but mom wanted to see them. So I would go with her. And she sat in the back and I like to sit in the front. So all the action and bone jarring, it was all over. And I'll tell you, like I have seen it since then, but it's been a really long time. But it's since it's been such a long time, I was wondering how I would react to it when I watched it for this. It's just as I remember it. You know how you see a movie when you're a kid and you think and then you see it again as an adult and you're just like, oh, I see it differently. There are so many, you know, straits that I didn't, subplots or whatever, or so much emotion that I didn't capture when I was a tiny child. And that's probably true, but it's really the movie mm-hmm. I remember, which is very joyful for me because I loved it as a kid and I loved it watching it again. It was so much fun.
You know, it's funny. I agree with that in some respects. Very much the last hour and a half of the film is very much as I remember it and holds up very well. What I don't remember from having seen it many, many times as a kid is how sort of cheesy TV movie of the week all of the 30 minutes that leads up to the tsunami is.
Oh, yeah.
And all that character development is so, it's almost Love Boat level.
I was going to say, it's not only we'll before that, Titanic, but it's before the Love Boat, and I got that too.
Yeah. How about you, John? Well, do you remember when you saw it first?
Well, like Steve, I was probably about 7 or 8 years old. I tried to pin it down in my memory. So I was yeah, well, much younger than I am now, put it that way. Anyway, I remember I walked into the main TV room and my mum was watching it. And I asked her what it was, and she said, "Oh, this ship kind of gets tipped over, sort of thing." And I'm like, "Oh, really? Interesting." And so I sat down, I watched it, and I think after about I don't know how long, but I saw from roughly just about 10 minutes after, well, 5 minutes after they tipped over, sort of thing, and then I gave up after about maybe 45 minutes or so, I guess, because I never saw the end. Because I'm like, this is just anyway. Maybe I was just I was born to be an engineer or something. I don't know. Anyway, I got up and walked off. And anyway, yeah, I know. It doesn't sound inspiring, but when I actually came back to rewatch it again, I'm like, I can see why people make a big deal out of this movie. I can see why it's a classic. For all of the little issues that it has, it's still a fun movie, in air quotes, fun. If you think disasters are fun to watch, but, you know, so to speak, fun to watch.
Yeah, I also was a kid. I went to see it when it was released, and so I was just about 12 years old, and I think it in some ways scarred me for life.
Because, hooray!
Yay! But yeah, I mean, if people have listened to some of our other incomparable episodes about movies from this era, I call it, it's like Gene's, you know, special podcast therapy group to watch a film, you know, she was too afraid to see when she was little. Well, this one I actually saw. I did like it, but I mean, I know things are a lot different today, and a 12-year-old probably wouldn't be that blown away by the Poseidon Adventure. But at the time, I mean, when I think about, you know, there's dead bodies, there's nightmare material.
There are a lot of dead bodies, more than I remember.
Many bodies.
Yeah, I don't think I remember that. That's true. I sort of skated right by that when I was a kid.
Yeah. And
pretty soon they're going to run out of coats to throw over their faces.
I kept thinking about that. Like, you might need that coat. Don't waste it on throwing it over some dead person's face. Come on. But that's not what I thought when I was 12. When I was 12, I was like, oh my God, you know, they're burned and they're bleeding and they're just dying left and right. And so that was a bit traumatic, I would say. But I think for me, that as a kid, the formula worked, you know, because I cared about the characters, but I didn't have to get too involved in any backstory. The first part of the movie is only 24 minutes, and it goes by fast. They introduce, you know, they have their group of 10, so not quite a little more than a handful of people who make it, you know, into the next part of the movie. But they introduce them all very economically, plus the doomed bridge and engineering officer. So
perhaps not economically enough. I feel like this 30 minutes in the opening could probably have been trimmed down a little, and might have been if this was remade today, but you know, I'm sure mileage
may vary
on that.
Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah, I think it's economical when you compare it to other disaster films and even, you know, of the modern era. Let's get right to the ship turning over, I think is the right attitude. I did rewatch Airport, which I hadn't seen since the 70s, because it's sort of mentioned as like this Airport in 1970 was the film that like launched this genre. And it's nothing like the Poseidon Adventure, except that it has a lot of recognizable stars. It takes an hour and a half before anything happens on that airplane. So it's more of a soap opera.
Okay,
you know,
so maybe this is economical. That's
relatively speaking.
I mean, honestly, because I was waiting for what I know happens, it felt like it was taking them a long time to get through the opening. And I also felt like, I mean, the soap opera part and the sort of cheesy TV movie part is very definitely, we are going, here, let's meet our characters and let's see how they interact before the terrible thing happens. Mm-hmm. Oh, look, there's Leslie Nielsen and his whole crew, all of whom are going to die soon. Spoiler alert. And so it felt like it was taking a while, but I think that's mostly the anticipation of somebody who's seen the movie before and who kind of wants to get to the good parts.
I didn't find it too long. I was like, fine. And if you compare it to like the Titanic, we have a whole lot of soap opera before we start sinking the ship. So,
no, I don't think it ever gets boring necessarily. And it does go a long ways towards telling us who's who. You know, I feel like that could probably have been done in slightly less time. But
sure.
It never really drags. You know, it just feels maybe just a hair on the long side for what it's trying to do. I mean, they could certainly have introduced some of these, you know, things about the different characters and the fact that the Rosens are going to see their grandson, that could all have been done, you know, as they're traveling through the ship and stuff like that, and might have made it less of a contrast between the two parts. But it's still good stuff. It's just
yeah. I mean, I think what we think of as cheesy soap opera establishing script was not that cheesy back then.
Well, yeah, it's fair.
It was high drama.
I certainly don't remember it having been cheesy, although, of course, I was somewhere between the age of 8 and 15 probably when I watched this a million times. So, you know, cheese has aged over time. But
yeah.
I think it was pretty straightforward storytelling. I mean, remember, we compared it to TV movies, which is appropriate, but remember that TV movies were just kind of starting at that point. So it was straightforward storytelling. And you do have to establish the relationships, not only between the characters who know each other, but the ones who don't. I think for me, the part of it that really threw me off was that it kind of takes place, it begins in the morning of a day, and then the climactic scene is that night in the ballroom. And so I'm a little unclear, like the the pace at which the day moves by while we're meeting all these people is sort of a little unclear to me. Oh, the band is rehearsing now. I see. Okay.
Yeah.
And I guess it's just a little bit of a pacing thing, but I don't know that I can't like look at it and say, well, this scene needs to be gotten rid of because I think we need the scene with the crew on the bridge. And why does it happen? Not only do we have the sort of evil ship owner who wants to move fast, but oh, by the way, there's an earthquake as well, a sequel as well, which causes Leslie Nielsen to tell them to go hard left, you know, toward the sequake. I guess because you can't outrun it. But I couldn't think of specific scenes to cut. Again, I think for me, it was just sort of anticipation of. And I'm eager to like look at what we know about the characters before this traumatic thing happens.
Yeah.
And I'm trying to remember, and I knew the actors that I recognized, which was most of them. I'm trying to remember, okay, wait, who's going to be in the group that is going to fight through the ship and who is going to die almost instantly? And mostly I remembered that, but I was sort of focused on that while I was watching the beginning part.
Well, and you do get some great stuff in this opening 30. You get you know, Hackman describing himself as the best kind of preacher, angry, rebellious, critical, a renegade, which is fantastic. You get Leslie Nielsen, presaging maybe some of his Naked Gun work with his deadpan delivery of "you irresponsible bastard," which is fantastic. You get Eric Shea.
Adorable.
The younger brother of Chris Shea, the original Linus from A Charlie Brown Christmas, jumping up and down on his bed and telling his sister to shove it, which is great. Although, kids, if you're ever on a cruise ship and the third engineer promises to take you to Broadway and show you the propeller shaft, don't go. go to the fiery sermon about how God helps those who help themselves instead. It's a bad idea.
I want to point out some of the first 24 minutes is the opening credits, which are all showing the ship itself in the highest seas, tossing and turning, which is very ironic. I think, Shelley, to your point about how is it one day, it's actually 2 days, I think, because
I think so too,
The day that the ship is making everybody seasick, and then and nobody is sitting out on the deck like the Rosens on that day. It's not till the next day.
That's right. That's a good point. Mm-hmm. I got my time all signatures all messed up in my head.
No, but I like the ship. I like the shots of the ship. I think it's kind of funny this time for the first time I realized like this super dramatic opening with the rough seas. And it's not the rough seas that flip the ship over.
Yeah, it has nothing to do with what ends up happening. And the funny thing about the whole Mr. Lenarcos plot line is I feel like the fact that he makes them go full ahead and not take on a ton of ballast immediately probably has nothing to do with the fact that they flip either, ultimately.
There are other movies from, what's the name of it? I can't remember, but there's at least one other movie, probably more, ocean-going movies of a previous generation where that is the plot, where the ship owner is trying to get the cat. And I think actually that was in the real Titanic story. I think that was part of it, but where the ship owner is trying to get the captain to do something that the captain doesn't want to do for safety reasons, and so that's a story, but it doesn't go anywhere because that's not what capsizes them.
Mm-hmm. I don't know. I think we should hear from our chief engineer on this.
Look, honestly,
chief, what can you do about these stabilizers, man?
Well, you know. I mean, the stabilizers, for one thing, is not going to, it's interesting. Like you say, it starts out in the rough seas and you think, oh yeah, that's got something to do with it, but it's got nothing to do with it. And then the whole, seaquake thing. And can I just say, while it occurs to me, what captain says go left? It's port or starboard. What?
Right. Right.
Anyway, it's fine. It was Leslie Nielsen.
You know, we're a movie going audience in 1972. We might not be up on our seat.
But he had just
jargon.
Been told that the wall of water was on the port side. And then he goes, go left.
You know, it's the heat of the moment. Come on.
Oh, my goodness. Anyway. All right. So on the Titanic. Yeah, that's true. Actually, because the White Star Line were trying to actually prove that their ships were the fastest. And it was like a marketing thing. So that's actually a real thing. But whether or not that contributed to the disaster is, it's not. I don't think it's really a significant contributor to what happened on the Titanic. And certainly, like what happened here, if they'd been going slower, they still would have, you know, been hit by the tsunami wave. So I don't think that would have made any difference. As far as the ballast goes, well, so ballast, do we all know what ballast is on a ship? I'm just curious.
No. You can tell us.
Weight. I don't. It's weight.
Yeah, it's weight, exactly. Yeah. But it's for a very, very long time, probably since like steamships and so on, maybe not steamships, but a bit after that, there's ballast pumps. What they'll do is they'll fill the outer tank. Now they'll fill the tanks in the bottom of the ship, right in the bottom of the hull, with water, and then that will essentially help the ship to be more stable, particularly when it's going through rough seas. But so
right, and that's why the issue at the top is not that the stabilizers are off; it's that there's not enough ballast, and their pump is broken. They're trying to fix the pump.
Yes, exactly.
To bring on the ballast.
Yeah. So is exactly right. So in rough seas, if you don't have enough ballast, then the ship does run the risk of tipping over in rough seas, which is technically true. But it's the sort of thing that, and of course, the more ballast you have, you know, the deeper it sits in the water. Therefore, you know, the slower it will ultimately go. But it's not a huge restriction to speed or anything. So it has an impact, but it's not massive. So I don't know. I found that whole thing to be a little bit of an odd conversation. What did they say was 60 feet high, the wave or something like that? I mean,
I think he says that's the peak of waves that he has experience with.
But I mean, if a wave is that...
The kid says they can go to 300 feet or something ridiculous. So Leslie Nielsen calms him down and says 60 is probably about the peak of what I've heard of.
So, but I mean, if you had more ballast or less ballast, it's not going to make any difference if you get hit by a wave that is that high. It's like the ballast, it's not going to save you. And stabilizers... they hate using stabilizers because it stabilizes like a kind of like a big airfoil thing underneath the ship that's designed to, or it depends on the design, but it slows the ship down, but it's designed to increase the horizontal profile so that the waves don't cause it to bob around so much in really rough seas, and it slows you down. You can't go anywhere near as fast, but it's for passenger comfort or whatever they say, you know. So it's not going to stop the ship from... Like if you get hit by a rogue wave like that, it's like, you know, okay, it's not going to help you.
Right. Although his instinct to turn hard to port
thank you.
Is probably the right one, because you want to hit that wave head on. You don't want it to hit you broadside. That's what's going to tip you. And
totally.
The issue is he can't turn quick enough, which I have issues with that as well, because they do spot the wave on the radar very, very early, long before he decides he should probably turn towards it. And that seems like the first thing you would do, seeing something that size off of the port bow.
That's my question too about the radar. Can you see a wave on radar?
I wouldn't have, no, generally not. And if you did, because, I mean, for radar to work, it's got to bounce off of something conductive. And, I mean, yes, this water's conductive, so it should bounce off of it. But, I mean, generally, radar's useless at low angles because there's too many other things. I guess if you're out at sea and maybe, I don't know, but I mean, not for sure anyway. I've never heard of radar detecting a towering wave before.
The question I have about the wave is, do tsunamis break? Because this one is definitely breaking. And it makes me think that this is not really a tsunami we're seeing. It's just a zoomed in footage of a wave off of Santa Monica that we're seeing.
It probably was. Now, I guess the thing with that is, when I did the episode about Fukushima on causality, I did a lot of reading up on tsunami, so I'm cheating a bit here. But the problem is when you're out in the deep water, you'll barely notice it. It'll be just like a little ripple. It needs shallow water in order to actually convert that energy into something that's really high.
Right.
And so he says in there, oh, it's building in the shallows. It's like, okay, but is your boat in the shallows? Because if your boat's in the shallows and the tsunami wave hits the shallows, then it will probably be a much bigger wave when it hits you. Don't even, you know, it might even break, but maybe, but I doubt it, because in order for it to break, most tsunami waves, when they compress up on the shoreline, then they break as they hit the shoreline. So unless the boat was actually sitting right there at the shore, it should not have had a wave anywhere near that high. And most boat, like ships out in the ocean, a tsunami wave goes past, they don't even notice it because the water's so deep, all that energy is dissipated over a huge depth, so it's just a tiny ripple. It's only a problem when it gets to the shore and the shallows, and they weren't near the shore. So
I appreciate them saying that, because they didn't have to add that bit about the shallows to add that bit of realism. But that said, it's based on the earlier discussion, they're probably several days out of Athens still. So yeah, where are the shallows out there in the middle of the Atlantic?
Right. So the movie is over before it begins, essentially.
Yeah. No, it's ruined. This movie's ruined.
Well,
for
and never
me.
Mind the pace of the lookout calls and sees the wave. The captain walks really slowly across to talk to him.
Yes, no
and
big
by
deal.
Then, that wave is like right there.
Yeah. It's a very scary looking wave. And I
and
think.
A quick shot.
Yes. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think there's only so. I mean, yeah. I mean, this is before this, when we still said tidal wave for what is a tsunami. That back then, the word tsunami was not like widely in currency. But I was noticing, I was looking at some clips of the remake, 2006 remake, which I'm otherwise not watching or recommending. But one thing they do I thought was interesting is the wave comes up and covers the moon partially so that you can see like something behind it to get that feeling of like, this is a big, big wave. So, but yeah, let's not even discuss whether that's possible either.
I think though, like the shot, the tension, so mm-hmm. that they did really well. And mm-hmm. I found the whole movie, the water being the same in the Titanic movie, with the oncoming water is always this point of tension that really drives the story and the action forward. And it starts mm-hmm. with that wave kind of coming in and crashing. Yeah. And you're just like, we're going to tip.
Yeah.
It's very exciting.
Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with BiteClear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, what's your secret? Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. BiteClear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
So, well, let's talk a little bit about the tipping, the scene. I mean, that scene in the ballroom as it's turning over, and that's the big scene of the movie, which they actually used in the trailers. So people knew that was going to happen. And also to the, you know, the question, spoilers, the ship turns upside down. Even the poster showed the ship upside down. So, right now questioning why my parents let me go see this, but whatever.
Well, first they set the stage with some truly terrifying groovy dancing of the 70s style. And of course, the song from the Poseidon Adventure, as it is titled, before yes. it had become The Morning After, which, yeah, makes me want to tip over and drown.
Oh, that was such a huge hit. That was on the radio.
And
all
I think
the
that's
time.
Why I remember feeling like they repeat the song in the movie, which they do not.
Well, they do, but actually. She practices it. And then
yeah,
she
but,
sings
but
later.
Like twice, but it was an yeah. enormous hit, and I think it was just sort of, I probably heard the song before I saw the movie, and so I feel like that song was drummed into my head at some point.
Yeah, I had a recollection yeah. of them taking off in the helicopter to that song as they flew off, but
that's skipping ahead a lot.
So can I ask a question about that, the tipping over scene?
Yes.
Like, how did they film it? Because I have my notes. The fall yeah. acting is great in this. Like, yeah. hello, everyone falling. You're doing right. an awesome job. And I was going, are they actually, like, are they just, like, fake falling and they're moving the camera? Or did they actually tip some floors? Does anyone know that?
They tipped. They tipped yeah. the floors. Not, they couldn't tip them, you know, to 90 degrees or 180. But they tipped them using, like, a forklift, a 45 degree angle. So there was a certain amount of actual physics.
Really?
In the,
that seems unnecessary, but that's impressive.
But yeah, yeah. It did feel like these people are falling like pretty realistically.
Right.
I like to imagine they didn't tell the actors exactly when it was going to happen and they just punched the button. Yeah.
Well, and then they intersperse it with these shots of just people with their arms up flying by the cameras going, ah!
Yeah. Well, I think that is a classic, genre moment of sure. all, you know, just close-up cameras all over the place showing mayhem and yeah. and terror.
It's very effective, yeah. especially the scene where the guy falls to the, I guess, what's the side of the ship at that point, and then the piano falls on top of
yes.
him, which is fortunately piano. Not as graphic as it could be, but man, uh-huh. it's visceral.
Yeah,
it is. I jump every time. I've watched it several times, even just recently, and I'm like, oh, I would like to skip over that because it hurts to see that. And again, you know, talk about dead bodies. There are yeah. a lot of them.
So the genius of the production design at building those giant ornate glass lights.
Yes.
That the falling scene concludes with the fellow falling off of a table,
oh, God.
You know, mm-hmm. back, just landing on his back on the lights. And then, you know, the sort of electrical reaction to that is fantastic. Yeah. It's such a perfect capper on top of that scene.
Yeah. It was done so well, that bit.
That was a great moment. And they could show that in the trailers. It really didn't give anything away. And you really kind of want to watch it twice, at least, to see, you know, like watch it once in the theater when you already kind of know that's coming and pay attention to some of the details. This is special effects, 1970s style, real effects.
Right. And the fact that it holds up 50 years later is really a testament to how what a great job they did on it.
Yeah.
There's a lot of movies from 1972 that do not hold up this way.
And, you know, just to throw in a little more production trivia, the budget for Poseidon Adventure was just under $5 million.
Wow.
Which was a lot, it felt like, to them then. But relative to the Titanic budget, even corrected for the inflation calculation, it's like in 1997, $5 million would have been $20
million. $5 million feels like nothing for this. The amount of work
the
Titanic they did on the
sets alone. $200 million. So they've spent 10 times as much money on the Titanic. And I mean, one thing is pretty clear. They didn't pay actors the way they do.
No. Well, clearly not. I mean, we haven't true. Really talked about the all-star cast of this movie.
Yes,
this point,
let's
but
do.
It feels like they would have at least commanded a half of that $5 million.
We have five Oscar winners to begin with, plus people who either would go on to or had careers on TV and in movies. Mm. Everybody's going to recognize somebody.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, Gene Hackman and Ernest Borgnine alone, which, what brilliant casting. I mean, if you've got a movie that's 90% people shouting at each other, those are two guys
so
that you get.
Shouting.
So much shouting, you're not wrong. Oh my God.
They had wanted Burt Lancaster for the Reverend part, which would also have been very shouty, as mm-hmm. well as just sort of more, because he's more physically intimidating than Gene Hackman, although he's older, and Lancaster turned him down.
I mean, obviously, this was my first introduction to Hackman and Borgnine, and even at 7 or 8 years old, I was like, "Ah, oh, this is a tour de force of shoutiness." But also, these guys could each individually carry a movie, you know, without you know having seen them in anything else,
and have
many times. Hackman had just won his Oscar for French Connection, mm-hmm. and Borgnine had been either lead or second banana in movies for 15, 20 years as you know tough guys and the like.
He also won Best Actor.
He did, for Marty.
For Marty in 1955. So you have two shouty Best Actor,
shouty Best Actor
winners.
So the others all won for Best Supporting Actor. You have Shelley Winters, who was nominated a number of times, and who I like to blow people's minds by showing them pictures of Shelley Winters in the late 40s when she mm-hmm. was just starting out and as an actress. And she's a bit of a bombshell sex mm-hmm. pot, if you want to use that term. And I think how she plays this part, and I think she's pretty brave, and she's only 52 at this point. Like, she's a lot younger than Jack Albertson, who's playing her husband, also an Oscar mm-hmm. winner, supporting an mm-hmm. Oscar winner. And she just is very game about the whole thing. And she was the one that was for this movie nominated for Best Supporting Actor, having, like I say, already won a couple of times.
As well, she should, because
yes.
she has the best scene
brave.
In the movie.
Yeah.
And then you have Red Buttons and Jack Albertson, who both won for Best Supporting Actor. Jack Albertson would go on to co-star in Chico and the Man, a 70s TV series. Red Buttons was like all over, he was like a comic and all over Dean Martin mm-hmm. roasts and stuff. And like Shelley Winters, was like a professional talk show guest. Both of them would, like in the 70s and 80s, go on talk shows and just be funny in very different ways. But it's interesting to see them both, you know, working hard in this movie.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then there's Roddy McDowell, who's robbed for Planet of the Apes. Should have definitely won Best Actor for that.
He's kind of robbed here, too. He's not really given enough to do, in my opinion.
Yeah, underutilized. Yeah. Underutilized, Roddy McDowell.
Even before he killed him off, he was just not given much to do. And I thought he was interesting. Yeah, and what is his character, really? He seems to be sort of shy, but yeah, it feels like they could have done more with him. He had been a child actor.
He's into this new groovy music over the glasses. Yes.
All the way back to Lassie come home when he was a little kid, and then he continued.
He thinks tying a sheet around the top of a Christmas tree is a suitable way to anchor it for people to climb up.
But Gene Hackman apparently believes it's okay, because he's like, sure, that's fine, no problem.
Yeah. You can trust him. He's got that accent.
Pamela Sue Martin became... You know, like, I remember feeling like, I guess I didn't know who she was when I first saw it, but she was, you know, television.
An up-and-comer at this point.
Up-and-comer.
And, she became big deal in Dynasty 10 years later.
A teenage phenom. And she was Nancy Drew at one point.
Oh, was she?
Which is, yes. And Carol Lindley was... I think she was the first cover model on 17 magazine. But
she had a long acting career, which I find hard to believe because she is not good at this.
No, she did a ton of TV movies. You talk about cheesy TV movies. That was kind of her thing.
Yeah, maybe she works in that environment.
She's pretty young in this.
Yeah.
So maybe she got better.
She already had a fairly sizable filmography before this. I looked last night.
She did from the mid-60s on.
Yeah.
And
I think, to be fair, like, I agree she's not very good, but I also think the lines she's given are terrible. She only gets to say really awful things the whole time.
Well, she's supposed to be hippy-dippy, and she really leans into that. I feel like she may have already had the brown acid a couple of times and has sort of been permanently scarred by that. But, I mean, she's also supposed to be playing somebody who's clearly in shock and, you know, having great difficulty dealing with the death of her brother and having to climb up ladders and smokestacks and that sort of thing. So I'm willing to forgive, but...
Her screams were okay. They were
it's tough to hold your own against the shouty... mastery that's going on around her. So, and then of course you've got Stella Stevens, who's no slouch in the shout department herself.
Indeed, great.
And
She was given many lines to shout, and she's like, Ernest. I can imagine the audition. Like, okay, you and Ernest Borgnine shout at each other. Just shout, because
you don't have to shout.
Apparently, you do.
And then she proceeds to shout back at him. But anyhow. Yes.
You son of a bitch, go help him. I love her, though. She's great in this. She is spicy. The hooker with the heart of gold, which really she doesn't have a heart of gold. She's actually kind of awful, but she's great in this.
And you know, Leslie Nielsen, this is obviously long before he becomes the parody disaster guy.
I mean, this is where he got the gig, right? I mean...
I don't know. Like,
it feels like when they picked him up for Airplane, and this is what they were playing.
Yeah, it feels like it's very much like, so people who would have seen him as this guy in Airplane would have gone, oh, wow. Just like George Kennedy was in two of the Airport movies, he kind of played that role.
Yeah.
Yeah, I do kind of wonder also whether the whole do you like movies about gladiators scene was based on the third engineer showing the young fellow the propeller shaft. It just feels like it could have been a follow-on from that.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective, unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
Well, what do you say we get to I think it's time to make our way to the galley.
It's time for disaster.
Time for, you know, get that Christmas tree going. And I did love all the little touches like that, even when I was a kid, especially like, oh, they would climb up a Christmas tree. Yes. they get to this one little spot, this little overhang, and that is like so underscoring the fact that they're going in the opposite direction from
right.
bottom
well,
to top.
It was an overhang. Now it's an underhang.
I thought, oh, that's convenient.
But the brilliance of this movie for me, the thing that always has fascinated me about it is that if there are two things that kind of unnerve me more than anything else, it's, well, it's kind of one thing, but things that are totally normal things but that are somewhere where they're not or in a state that they shouldn't normally be in. Mm-hmm. Like, for instance, things that are upside down just hold a kind of a real unnerving fascination for me. And things that are underwater as well, yeah. You know, that look different because they happen to be under a certain amount of water. And this movie is so full of those things. And the genius of having... you know, everything be upside down and them having to go to the bottom of the ship to get to the top is so great. And it, mm-hmm. it actually makes me wonder if the impetus for this movie wasn't somebody thinking about, you know, what would it be like if everything was upside down and how would you get around? And like, and the fact that, you know, the only real setting you could put that in is maybe like a ship that flips over might've been a follow on as opposed to the real impetus of the, because it's really the stroke of genius for this movie for me.
Imagining somebody putting the film in upside down and going, whoa, that's a good idea. Let's do that.
Well, I do think that the idea came from, you know, from the author of the original novel, The Poseidon Adventure. He had been, years before, had been a passenger on the Queen Mary when it was hit by a big wave that tilted the ship such that things went flying. And he, you know, so he had like a little mini experience of the ballroom scene being in the, or, you know, the dining room.
Queen Mary being another star of this film, by the way.
Yes, which is interesting. Like yeah. They did, you know, and by the way, much bigger than the Titanic. Still
and
a shorter
very creepy
movie.
Setting, by the way. If you ever have the opportunity, yeah. If you're in Long Beach to go aboard the Queen Mary and... tour through the bowels of the ship. It is a fascinating.
I'd like to do that.
And I've heard it's haunted.
Well, they do have ghost tours that go off mm-hmm. every night, and actually a portion of the ship is now a hotel, so you can stay there overnight and then take a ghost tour and then, you know, listen to the ship creak around you as you drift off to sleep. But yeah, just wandering through this gigantic, largely deserted relic of a time gone by is truly fascinating, and I very much recommend it.
Yeah. Well, I do think that sounds like another disaster movie waiting to happen.
But with the Queen Mary, that when it got hit by the rogue wave, so the story goes, it was in the 40s, I think it was tilted something like 50-something degrees. So mm-hmm. I think that they figured out afterwards, and it was the discussion was that if it had been another 3 or 4 degrees, it would have actually capsized. So it came so damn near close to actually capsizing. And and the author of the book was actually on the boat at the time. I think that was, yeah. But the book was written in the 60s. So, I mean, obviously that festered a while in the back of his mind before he wrote it in the book. So, but anyway, mm-hmm. the ship survived.
It really survived. And it's good that they had that as a set. They could use, which they did all the early stuff before the ship flipped over. They didn't actually flip it over, which maybe today James Cameron would want to do, but
never give him a credit card. See what he does with
it. I thought we'd just like sort of step through the scary parts and see if anybody has some favorites or things that they thought were especially scary. I mean, the second big dramatic beat is when they have gotten to the top of the Christmas tree, our band of 10, and something explodes in the engines, and it makes the water starts coming into the ballroom and the fire starts and
that's never entirely clear what keeps exploding. I feel like the script in its various parts just has that direction. Something explodes.
Can things explode? Like they keep showing explosions underwater, and I was like, does that happen? But I just...
You'd think it'd be more explodey higher up or lower down, as the case may be. And then there's all these little fires, like, everywhere. And you're like,
That makes sense to me. But it's like they keep showing the shot of the ship underwater, and then there's, like, explosions going out into the water, which...
But it gives them the opportunity to show that that upside down model of the ship lit by funky colored lights, a couple more times.
It's kind of pinky, blue, green. Yeah, it's very awesome. Fancy.
Yeah, I was a bit confused by the explosion things too, because diesel doesn't explode. So if the diesel engines, like, they're going to, if it's, was it a diesel or was it, because it looked like it was not a, it did not look like it was a steamship.
No.
So it doesn't really explain that, but I thought it was a diesel. Diesel doesn't explode. But then the gas that they use for cooking definitely would, because you could see when it was going through the kitchen area, there was all those little fires, that would be from the gas from the cooking system. That makes sense. Beyond that, I'm struggling at what else would explode, certainly underwater, unless they had some C4 or something. And we're carrying C4. No, probably not. In fact, C4 wouldn't have been invented.
It's common on cruise ships.
Yeah, we take it everywhere in case you need it.
Right. Uh-huh. just like big red wheels that make steam shoot out. You got to have a few of those.
Yes, indeed.
I also like at that point too, with they're standing at the top, and then they really hit you home very subtly with the theme of the movie. Are we people of action, or are we people who just wait to be rescued and hope God will save us, or are we going to ask ourselves? It's very subtle.
God helps those who help themselves, but also sometimes God just sacrifices you for no good reason. So there's that. Right.
Because God is a prankster.
But that is a wonderful scene in the ballroom with the purser played by, you've seen him everywhere in the 1970s, character actor Byron Webster, who was also incidentally in Skinflint, A Country Christmas Carol. So, one degree of separation from the Poseidon Adventure. pretty proud of it. But he's convinced everybody that the right thing to do is just to stay there in the ballroom. And surely, somebody's going to carve through the hull and get all the way down into the upper part of the ship, before they all drown. And so what they convince maybe however many, 8 people are that make the rest of the journey, and everybody else is still down there. And of course, there's that explosion, and then water starts rushing in, and everybody is, in utter bedlam trying to make their way to the Christmas tree, which naturally, they get to the top and it immediately tips over and everybody falls back to their doom. And I have to say, I probably shouldn't feel a sense of satisfaction when they all get swallowed up, but I totally do. It's like, you dummies, you should have gone with
them. Now you want to get out. Now you want to go up the tree. Oh, great.
Yeah.
Bad timing, guys.
And we don't actually see Gene Hackman push it over when they get to the top.
But we know it happened.
Yeah. No, that's true. That I, again, as a kid, I was like, first of all, I thought, well, I know how the movie is supposed to go, but I'm thinking I might wait, because who knows what's going to happen if you try to get out of here. And this is like before we saw Titanic or anything else, like with water like creeping up every level. Even in this movie, you don't see that until much later, actually. It's kind of surprising. I mean, in the plot, if I would have felt like, and I did feel like as a kid, like if they weren't already submerged in water in the ballroom, why maybe they're set until somebody rescues them. So anyway, I would have been one of the ones would not have made it to the Christmas tree myself.
I think it comes down to whether you trust Gene Hackman as your leader, because I would have been looking at, who is that guy? He's kind of a shouty preacher talking about winners.
Shouty.
When I,
right.
Very
and
bossy.
I don't know if I, and he's fighting with Ernest Borgnine. And
well, I know he's angry, rebellious, critical, and a renegade. That much is clear.
But he's also right.
Well, he's making the point. You can sit here and see what happens, or you can make an effort to get yourself, somewhere that's more likely to be close to where the rescue effort is going to come from, which makes perfect sense. I understand where the people that stick around are coming from, particularly those who are injured. You're not going to go crawling through the ship. And then, of course, Byron Webster, who is so pompous, it's a very short performance from him, but he's wonderful in it. And He is the recipient of that fantastic line from Gene Hackman. It is true, you pompous ass. Which, but he seems like he knows what he's talking about. Clearly, he doesn't. But he seems like the sort of guy you'd hang around with because he says.
Yeah.
Maybe he knows what he's talking about.
Yeah. So then begins the part of the movie which goes like, "Let's get somewhere. We can't get through here. Let's have some shouting. Let's get through this way or another way. Somebody dies. Let's repeat." I mean, that's pretty much, and with bigger stakes each right. time, I would say, because mm-hmm. they do knock off acres like that.
It's various set pieces that you might expect to see in a ship, but upended.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Which is great. You know, you get what I'm assuming is the smokestacks, or maybe it's just the boilers that they have to go up/down in, which is where Akers meets his untimely demise.
Well, you knew someone's going to fall at that point. You don't have like that beautiful long stairway without dropping someone down.
Right.
And Rogo tried to save him, which was
admirable.
He
really did. I forgot
People are going to die, and you have to pace the deaths through the movie. And the question is, giving the number of people you start with, how many are going to survive and also who? And if you haven't seen the movie, I mean, I don't know if I did this when I was a kid. I did mostly remember who's, I certainly remember a couple of the deaths pretty vividly. But you're sort of making odds and you're, well, they're not going to kill the little kid. Who else aren't they going to kill? And, you know, you just sort of play the odds as an audience member. And it's kind of fun.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That scene is horribly unfair to Mr. Rogo, too. I always thought it was a great injustice that nobody ever got the point across to Gene Hackman that he had dove in to try and save.
Right.
Yeah. To save I was mad Acres. About that.
Yeah. And it's like, where were you? He's challenged. Like, where were you? He's like, in the water trying to save him.
Yeah.
Where were you? Hanging off a ladder? Gee, thanks.
I dove off the ladder and tried to swim down and find the guy. He shuts up the kid before he can tell him. And I always thought that was unfair.
Agreed. That was, I think Rogo comes off best after on a second viewing, you know, but.
Also, I'm like, Rogo's pretty cut.
Yeah.
Just from the, I'm watching this for pretty people sometimes. I was like, dude, you are cut. You could.
Wow. I've nice never work. Heard anybody refer to Ernest Borgnine as
Nor
pretty
have I.
People.
But he's got like some good muscles going on and stuff when he's doing a lot of this stuff. I'm like, he does not look like he would be as strong as he is, I think. And I was like, that surprised me.
He was around, you know, for a while as the big tough guy and the guy who could. Mm-hmm.
He's in his mid-50s at this point. So, you know,
well, he's not a small guy. He's definitely, mm-hmm. but.
Another thing they say about the making of this film is the actors got increasingly competitive doing their own stunts.
Oh, I shout the loudest.
But the shouting it's technically not a stuntman's job.
There's dangling, there's climbing, there's swimming, there's all these things.
The way Hackman and Borgnine do it, this is a stunt. Yeah, there's some wonderful set pieces here. I think my personal favorite is when I cannot remember his name, but the young kid played by Eric Shea.
Robin.
That's it. Yes,
Shelby is his last.
At some point, while Hackman forges ahead to try to find the engine room, they're all going around trying to find useful things. And at some point during that, the kid realizes he has to use the John. So he goes and finds the gentleman's room and he goes in and everything is upside down and all the urinals are about 10 feet above his head. And it is hilarious.
Water's dripping.
And of course it's all dripping out.
Right.
Yeah. That was memorable as a kid. That was definitely one of
totally.
The memorable
and then
scenes,
of course that's that leads to him being somewhat left behind and Gene Hackman has to go get him, and that's the immediately following scene is exceedingly memorable, where the water that we've been seeing rising up as they go from deck to deck finally busts through on the deck that they're on, and then you see a cramped corridor with a wave coming down it and the two of them being blasted forward. It's a wonderful tense scene.
Mm-hmm. So tense. Yeah.
And that actually reminds me of another engineering question I have, is they constantly going through and undoing sealed doors.
Yeah.
Should they be sealing them back up?
I would have.
A couple times where I'm, right?
I would have.
Okay.
If you could.
There is a point where they go through a hatch and they do close it behind them. But yeah, there's a lot of places where they don't.
Yeah, I counted that one too. I think it was just the one. So it was like, good job. This one. You probably should have done the others. But I mean, also some of those are actually only openable from one side. And also thinking about like the problem of that, wouldn't that be annoying to actually climb up like the part of the exhaust stack and come out that little side passageway and then find you couldn't open it because the bulkhead is actually bolted from the other side? That would be immensely frustrating. Fortunately, they didn't write themselves into that dead end. But I mean, right.
There are a few places where you think that's going to happen. Like they've finished crawling through the smokestack and they crawl through another ventilation tunnel and you get to the end and there's a grate, which you don't actually see Gene Hackman kick through. And for a bit there, you think he's going to be stuck behind that. And you're like, oh God, how horrible must that be?
Just like a little mesh thing and you can't get through it after all this effort you've taken.
You can see the other side. You just can't get there.
The other thing, just on the water and the water following them, gushing through the ship and everything, one of the things that contrasting with Titanic, I thought Titanic was, in many ways, it's almost more dramatic to see the water level rising steadily and creepily in a lot of those scenes, whereas in this film, it always seemed to be gushing or exploding in. It never seemed to trickle in. And I just thought that was a bit odd because if it's sinking, it's going to trickle in quite a bit. And you might see points where it's gushing in where there's a breach or something. But in this movie, every single scene where the water's ingressing, it's exploding into the room, it looks like. And I don't know. It just felt weird. But anyhow.
And if it had happened that way, shouldn't the ship be rocking and listing more each time that happens?
Yeah, that's the other thing that's really, because the whole ship, as it takes on water from different sides, it's going to start to list and eventually it would eventually, you would think, actually land horizontally, like 90 degrees, not 180 degrees. So that's the other thing that's really strange. And I might let's just save that for the end. I don't want to spoil.
There is an engineering term you may be unfamiliar with called dramatic license.
Oh, that's what I was looking for. Thank you, Steve. Yes.
I love, though, that water that's rushing in from the floor below / above. The detail that I've always been impressed by there is that it's not just water. It's got a bunch of crap floating in it. It's like all of the detritus of the drowned people and their stuff that's flooded below them, rising up and chasing them. It's great.
Yeah. So then we get to that point where I do think the water like surprised them slowly was Gene Hackman coming back and saying like, oh, there was a corridor there. When I was just here and now it's underwater. So, that of course is setting up the big scene.
Fortunately, the water chose that moment to stop rising.
Yes.
Or they would have been in a great deal of trouble.
Yeah, and I definitely didn't understand it as a kid why they had to swim and then, how that would work, that they would then get up a level, go down a level to get up a level. But now, as an adult, I technically understand it, although I still have my questions. But so amazingly, until this moment, only one person has died from our group. Obviously, 1,300 other people have died.
But we don't care about those ones.
We have no interest.
None at all.
They didn't climb up the tree. Yeah, they went on board with the tree thing. So that's what happened.
That was their own fault.
That's right.
They had their chance. Although they never could all have gotten up that tree. But in any case, even if they had been willing to be patient.
I can't imagine why you would panic in that situation and all try to climb up.
Right.
We've got this scene where they've got to swim, and that's when we find out the big twist about Shelley Winters, which I did not see coming, that she was the ladies' underwater swimming champion. I didn't even know underwater swimming was a sport, even back then. I don't remember that, but whatever. She's going to
some 40 years previous, she earned that medal, and she's kept it. That was the peak of her life, apparently, because she's kept that medal ever since.
I mean, I would have
onto a cruise ship to wear with her fancy outfit on New Year's Eve.
Husband. Probably.
It's because it means life.
Yeah,
and life is very important.
I did love that, though, because you're like basically underestimating the middle-aged woman. And I was so excited by it. And then I was so mad.
What I love about it is she offers to help and says, let me do this.
Yeah.
And Gene Hackman is like, I think I can hold my breath for 35 feet.
He's, you know, so he's like, dismissive.
He's just incredibly dismissive. And then he goes on and he does it. And she's like, fine, whatever. And he gets stuck. And she comes and she has to save him at the cost of her life, which is tremendously sad. But I like that if they're going to do that, there's that sort of, because we're beginning to make Gene Hackman more fallible, you know, because for a while it's like Ernest Borgnine says, God, he's been right all along, which is super annoying because he's I hate him.
Why are you so damn sure of yourself?
Because I'm right. But now he's becoming fallible, and it took Shelley Winters saving him in this instance. Yeah.
But then they kill her with a heart attack. I would rather see her being killed by like cutting herself and bleeding out or falling off something, or like she could have still sacrificed herself, but the heart attack was like, that was just like, that's lame.
It's a bummer. At least she got a death scene. At least it's not like Acres where she just falls her off into the abyss and goes, ah! They would never have done that.
Her death scene is amazing, though. She's got those little...
She's great.
She's awesome.
As her heart stops. Oh, it's fantastic. And I first saw this movie probably 40 years ago, and nothing since has ever made me bawl in a movie like when she goes out and Gene Hackman starts just, oh, God, not this woman. It's so heartbreaking, and her acting in that scene is magnificent as well. It's wonderfully done. And you know Manny's on the other side. Yeah. And it as far as things that are unfair to Mr. Rogo, sending him back and just telling him, right,
don't tell him. And he has to go through again too. But he's not a spring chicken.
And he's probably uniquely ill-equipped to hide that information from Manny.
Yes, 100%.
He tries his level best, but the best he can do is, she got through. She got through.
Technically true.
As his eyes are like darting from side to side furtively.
No, she saved the preacher. She did. And, you know, just from the production point of view, they trained with underwater diving, which I at first was like, why? They're not breathing underwater. They aren't, but they are right before the scene starts shooting. They're underwater with the breathing apparatus. And then I don't know how many takes they had to do, but you know, that's again, something like that's real action underwater.
Yeah. They're having to do business. They're not just swimming. They're going upward and, you know, finding where they're going to go, and they mm-hmm. have them do stuff. And I'm actually remembering now that even though I wasn't probably body counting as a kid, I do remember being shocked at Shelley Winter's death, because if you're going to kill somebody, you're not going to kill the middle-aged woman that everybody kind of likes. It's just, it's very unusual. It's almost, they'd never kill the kid, but the second least likely to die, I think, would be Shelley Winters. And, you know, who survives? Jack Albertson. I figured he was toast, but
yeah.
But no, I just remember being shocked as a kid.
Yeah, when he stole fizzy lifting drinks, I thought he was going out like that. He was going to get chopped up in that fan, and that was it.
They could have used some fizzy lifting drinks on this
trip. Yeah, that would have been helpful.
That would have been helpful. Oh, but
she's so sweet, and the relationship with Manny is so, so lovely. It's unfair.
They're really good.
It's genuinely
is really unfair.
Now, is this all appears to be the real actors swimming around
it is
these
them.
Underwater
yes.
sets.
Yeah.
Which, that's,
I mean,
that's
at least
impressive.
It's Shelley Winters and Gene Hackman. I don't know for sure, like, whether there's some body doubles, like, of the other actors as they show them swimming through. Like, for example, Stella Stevens in her shirt and panties. So we get to the engine room, thanks to the sacrifice of Shelley Winters, and they have to climb a lot of catwalks, which... It is hard to see a lot of the details in this film, and that's, I think, one of the complaints over time, you know, and maybe there's a print now that is better, but, you know, I couldn't figure out, you know, what the layout of that final, the room where the final death scenes occur, but I'm mad about Stella Stevens because you could say she was fridged there. She falls off the catwalk after everything else.
And it's the heels.
to the heels, but they all had heels. All the women mm-hmm. had heels. And it just is setting up Rogo's big scene, which is a great scene. I agree. But it just, she could have had something more weighty to do than just mm-hmm. like lose her balance. That's my opinion. But
yeah, I had always only ever seen this in pan and scan aspect ratio on mm-hmm. the old VHS tape. And so I had always remembered that scene as her just sort of disappearing, but watching the Blu-ray, whatever print they used for it, mm-hmm. You know, you can see her body down there, which
yes.
is...
I didn't remember that either until this time. Like,
it has
I don't
solved
think
a mystery that's been with me for many years.
yeah. So anyway, so now we're down, like very quickly, down two more of our handful of survivors, and we get...
that makes it all the more awful, too, the fact that so many of them get so close.
Yeah.
I mean, Shelley Winters very nearly made it.
Yeah.
Yeah, and a lot of movies like this, they would pace it so that more die early on, because what they're going to do with the other characters is have them have a lot of chance to mourn the people who've passed. They do, especially in military war movies, where you have like a group of 20 that ends up becoming four, and there's a lot of time for the guys to sit there and mourn. But in this case, there's so much action going on that except for Manny mourning Shelley Winters and then Ernest Borgnine doing his speech later, there's not really a lot of time to process it because they got to keep going.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Right.
True.
So, yeah, so we're down to seven. Reverend Scott is like, there it is. There's the way. And there's one more of those mysterious explosions, of course.
Something explodes, the script says.
Something explodes. And I guess the pipe gets, I don't totally understand this part either, really, from a physics point of view, is that there's a valve that has steam blowing out of it. And it didn't before, but
you
got to
have
close
those. It's maritime
it.
Law.
He can. It's not like a pipe broke, and because otherwise he wouldn't have been able to shut it off, right? Mm-hmm. Anyway, I don't know. I don't want to pick apart the very final thing.
It's sort of like he's a cartoon character hanging on that valve. It just was. It's like. Yeah, you know, the Acme Valve Company made it, and the little cartoon character has to close it by hanging on it, which of course will mean his doom.
And I love how bright red and obvious it is. It's like plot device here. There's big arrows pointing to it. It's great. I always assumed that the way that worked is that the pipe, which is carrying steam for some reason, which, you know, like I said, you need it. The Coast Guard will actually board your ship and check to make sure you've got one of those. I assume that it broke farther down the line, and then he like closes off a junction with that wheel. But he has an amazing knowledge of how those steam pipes work for right. somebody.
Yeah, that's what I was struggling with. I mean, it's you know, it's an isolation valve, fine, and you go there and you isolate the steam. But how did he sit there and study the pipes and say, well, the steam's coming out here, so I've got to get upstream of that, and that's where the pressure's coming from. So I'll just close this. It's like, yeah, anyway, it's fine. I mean, it's fine, but okay.
I'm glad we had this discussion. It's been bugging me.
That's what I expect from a bunch of nerds talking about the Poseidon Adventure.
Now, when I was a kid, I thought for sure Gene Hackman would still survive. Obviously, as an adult, I look at it and say, yeah, there's no way he can do anything but fall. But I thought, oh, he closed it, and now he's going to somehow join them and get rescued. So yeah. I was disappointed.
He gets his big speech, railing yes. against God for taking all the people for no good reason.
Yeah. So now we're down to six, and Rogo, who's been kind of sidelined in his grief. Oh, Red Buttons gets a speech, finally, and gets to look like the tough guy, and he's essentially goading Rogo. How many times does Rogo go like, hey, watch it there, like,
that's
throughout
enough.
This movie? He doesn't hit anybody. You know, there's one little tussle, you know, along the way. But basically, in other movies, he's beaten people to a pulp. But in this, he just says, hey, watch your language, man.
That's enough. And then he moves
enough.
On. Yeah. They, Red Buttons
through.
Has a great speech, to be fair. Yeah. I mean, he pushes all the right buttons on Ernest Borgnine's character.
Mm-hmm.
It calls into question his abilities as a detective. I think that's what finally does it.
Yeah.
And I think, I mean, I think Shelley Winters' acting is clearly the standout, but I think Red Button's character is written really well, and I think he handles it well by underplaying it, because mm-hmm. Red Buttons can be sort of a ham, and he's a comic. And I think he just decides that the best way to handle it, knowing that he has a good part, is to dial it back. And then obviously he's got this sort of quasi-romantic relationship, protective relationship with the Carol Lindley character. So he's mm-hmm. he's sweet, as well as being sort of he's not competing for power with Borgnine and Hackman, which is right for his character anyways. But yeah, and it also makes him much more survivable at the end.
Yeah.
He seems like a really odd choice for that role, doesn't he?
It's weird.
Kind of. I mean, I think
really
it
any
works.
Comedy beats for that character.
Right?
I mean, he tells a couple of jokes at the table during the banquet for New Year's Eve, but they're not, you know, they're not sort of hammy.
I feel like he would have auditioned for that. Like, I don't think anybody would have said, you know what we need for this part is Red Buttons. And he probably would have auditioned and they would have gone, you know what? It kind of works. And yeah. people would have known the name just
he
in
was
the way
famous
that he,
back
yeah.
then. That
yeah,
was
well,
the
it absolutely
thing.
Works,
yeah.
but it's so strange yeah. to see him in that character because he's not a guy you would think yeah. for this sort of yeah. quiet, totally. Shy, possibly hypochondriac haberdasher, you know?
Yeah. And so, yeah, so they get through that final thing, which, again, they're lucky to be on the right side of, I guess. I hadn't thought about that. Unscrew that last hatch. Then bang on the ship's hull, attracting the rescuers who happen to be there.
Just
right
just happen
moment.
To be there
so
on top
convenient.
Of the ship in their helicopter
with
a blowtorch.
Sure, yeah. So.
And they don't say, hey, get out of the way, we're going to come through.
No, they
That's
don't.
The most improbable part to me of this whole movie is that they get to their destination and that they are rescued because they can bang on the ship and there happens to be a helicopter there. That's ridiculous.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's
it's
where
great
we needed the C4.
Fun. I love it, but it's ridiculous.
Well, and then the funny thing is they just take off in that helicopter. It's like, mm-hmm. there's probably other people, but oh well, we got
hey,
these
how many
six.
Of y'all are down there? There's six. Okay, let's go.
That's all we got room in the helicopter
right.
for. So we're out of here.
An hour later, another group comes through and are like,
what the hell?
They're sitting on top of the
going
there's
already.
Helicopter yeah. tracks up here. Where did it go?
Well, at least there's a hole. We can get the hell out of here. At least we can be eaten by sharks instead of drowning.
So we'll be good on the bottom of a ship out in the yeah. open ocean. I'm sure we'll be fine.
No problem.
That's great. But they also mentioned, did you save anybody else from the bow? And we didn't mention that phenomenally creepy scene where at one point
yeah.
they get to Broadway and they see this long procession of sort of zombified people walking towards the bow of the ship, led by the doctor who insists that that's the way to go. But of course, Gene Hackman knows that it's the stern you've got to go to because he has the magic child who knows everything about the ship. Having spent a great deal of very questionable time with a third engineer. But
it's the 70s. That's how kids are.
Yeah.
But it's a great moment when they get out and it's like, yeah, nobody from the bow. Basically six of the 1,000 people that were on the ship made it out. And it's kind of a shock at that moment.
Yeah. I do like that scene when they encounter those people because they see them from an adjacent corridor and you're right, they're zombified. And mm-hmm. even as Hackman is sort of running along the line to catch up with the doctor and nobody's speaking to him, but he gets to the doctor, they're moving downhill. So it's
yeah.
clear
mm-hmm. right.
they're going the wrong way. I mean, it's just clear. It's not even a thing of maybe the bow somehow is upturned. No, you're going downhill right now. That's not where you want to go.
And maybe, as it turns yeah. out, angry, rebellious, critical, and a renegade is not the best quality in a preacher, because clearly he has a tough time convincing anybody of anything. Even very obvious things like don't go down into the water.
Yeah. They didn't really try very hard. They tried much harder in the ballroom to get more people. And I guess they're just like, oh, well, whatever.
But both groups of people are just like, mind your own business, dude. We've yeah, decided to head to
true.
Our doom.
Let us die in peace,
And so when they say nobody got out at the bow, I once again feel a somewhat guilty sense of satisfaction. You dummies.
Well, no spoilers for future sequels. Let's just say, if you really want to see some more people, there is beyond the Titanic. I mean, beyond the Poseidon Adventure. Right. Please, no sequels to Titanic. Please,
I'm just
please.
Saying, if you're ever in a disaster situation and you see Gene yeah. Hackman, you know, as a potential person you could follow, that's the guy you follow.
Follow yeah. the Oscar winner. Is
it's
the
not
way
the random
it.
Character actor.
The shouty one heading up.
Follow
go
if,
up.
If the guy's got an Oscar that he just won like a year ago, that's who you follow.
That's right.
All right. Well, to me, the biggest tragedy of this film is right at the end when they get on the helicopter and they fly away, and that's it. They initially wanted to have a shot of the upturned ship, you know, like an aerial shot showing the ship in the water. But they ran out of money. And Irwin Allen was like, he said, like, he was like, no, we're not going over budget for that. So we'll just show them getting onto a helicopter and, you know, some pretend propellers and bye bye.
And I was surprised by that because I had a vivid recollection of seeing that exact shot. And I'm wondering if maybe the opening of Beyond the Poseidon Adventure had that
Our
shot.
Our movie watching
it.
Brains want the shot to exist, I guess. And you can see it. You can imagine that they would do the shot. And then as the shot is pulling out, the ship is clearly sinking.
Yeah, all you really need is that small section.
Yeah, it feels like you could have done that with a model reasonably well.
And all you would really need is that very small section of the stern of the ship sticking out, which would have just, you know, driven home the fact that the rest of the ship is pretty much gone.
Yeah.
But that's a bummer. But I must have seen the opening I think I've seen the opening scene of the Beyond the Poseidon Adventure at some point, because I know I've seen that shot somewhere.
Oh, that's not a joke. I thought you guys were joking about Beyond the Poseidon.
No, it's a thing. It is a joke. It might be a joke.
And
but
also
it is
a movie.
yes. If you didn't have enough Oscar power, go watch Michael Caine and Sally Field and some other people. Telly Savalas, not an Oscar winner, I'm pretty sure. Anyway, that's maybe for our rocket surgery someday we'll watch that.
I'm here
we'll
for that.
We'll reassemble. I wanted to wrap this up and get everybody's final thoughts and maybe... If you have anything on your mind about disaster genre in general, I think that would be interesting. But or will you watch Beyond the Poseidon Adventure? I think that's inadvisable.
Challenge accepted.
But don't go toward the bow and don't watch Beyond the Poseidon Adventure.
Well, Shelley, what are your final thoughts?
As I said, I love this movie. It is as I remember it. As a kid, I love all of the actors because both before and after this movie, they had such great careers. There's so much to say about them. It was so much fun. And yeah, I grew up in the 70s when these movies and the airport movies and Towering Inferno and Earthquake and all these movies were a thing. Irwin Allen Presents. That meant something in those days, man.
Land of the Giants.
This was definitely my favorite. I remember seeing Towering Inferno. And I don't know, I was more scared by that because fire freaks me out. And I mean, there's fire in this movie.
It seems a lot more plausible, too, to be honest.
And the airport movies I love, but I didn't think of them as disaster movies in the same way. They were just ridiculous, including, and I've said this before on podcasts, my favorite is how Charlton Heston gets in the plane to save the day in Airport 1975. Just watch it. It's amazing.
Yes.
Yeah, this genre is a lot of fun. And for me, because I'm not a horror person, I'm not even really a modern thriller person. I don't mind watching thrillers. But the sort of cheesy aspect and the fact that it's so plot-driven, there's a lot of action, of course, but it's really plot-driven and character-driven. I love that. I love that you can mix that. And that's what makes this movie so delightful and why I would watch it again and make people I know watch it.
Good.
Like people younger than me who never would have seen it, I mean.
Right. Well, we need to torture the youth. That's our calling. Steve, what about you?
Yeah. Like I said, I haven't seen this in at least two, maybe three decades after seeing a ton of it when I was younger. And I was very concerned that it wouldn't hold up. And I'm shocked to say and very happy to say that I think it does. I think they do just enough explanatory stuff to make it seem sort of plausible as a person who's not, you know, that sort of engineer. the sets and the whole upside down underwater element of it still works like gangbusters on me. You know, the cheesy lead up stuff is fine. But overall, yeah, it still, I think, is a pretty solid movie. I intend at some point to make my teenage and slightly older than teenage children watch this with me and see how it works on them, because, you know, times have changed a bit, but I think it still holds up pretty well. I did just want to throw in one quick props for John Williams' excellent score, which there aren't a lot of details that I remember about this movie. And like I said, I remember a lot of the dialogue, but there were points in this movie where the score swells and I remember the music cues note for note. You know, it's yes. subtle, it's in the background, but it's brilliantly done, and it is memorable in its own way, I think. So
yeah, I'm glad you brought that up. I was thinking about that. Oh shoot, we didn't even mention the score, which is brilliant and extremely haunting. I remember when it starts in the first few seconds of the opening credits, and I'm like, oh my God, I'm already scared, you know, that fanfare that they use. And I will say, I have been dipping into clips of The Towering Inferno, for which he also wrote the score, and it's like nothing compared to this. And I would say it sort of presages a little bit Imperial March feeling. Like, it's really seriously like moving and a little scary. And so, anyway, but thanks for bringing that up, Steve. Ned, did you want to give us your final thoughts?
Yeah, you know, something that kept coming up in my mind was like, whoever wrote the Doctor Who Christmas special set on the Titanic cruise ship in space?
Oh, yeah.
Clearly has seen this movie, because there was the falling down the pit. There's the older couple who, like, anyways, there's so many beats that I was just like, oh yeah, they definitely watched this and borrowed some beats from that story, which was very fun to me. And also, I just thoroughly enjoyed it. Like, the action, it holds up really well. I couldn't stop watching. I really got invested in the characters, and I love movies of this era. I'm almost the same age as this movie. I was born in 73, and there's something about watching movies from the 70s, though. It's just like, that's my, like, you just can't capture that era in a replica. Like, seeing the movies in that era, you just see the fashion, the things, everything. It's so familiar and so distant. It makes me all nostalgic. So I don't know. It's fun. I'd watch it again. I might watch Beyond the Pipe. Poseidon Adventure.
You will.
Who knows?
I've just looked it up. There are 4 Oscar winners in Beyond Poseidon Adventure.
Can we just do a rocket surgery about it? Because I love rocket surgery.
I mean, 4 Oscar winners, people.
So what you're saying, Shelley, is it's good.
No, I'm not. Not right. That's what I'm saying. Titanic. This one wins. But yeah, 4 Oscar winners. I'm saying rocket surgery the heck out of that thing.
Yeah, I'm like, let's do it.
All right. Well, please, maybe we can reassemble the crew. I'll ask the producer. And John, thank you so much for being here and giving us some true knowledge instead of our made up for movies knowledge about the ship's engineering.
No problem. I'm happy to help, and it's a bit of a thrill to be on the show, to be honest. I also the thing that I found about it is I looked at I have to suspend the engineer in me to really enjoy the rest of the movie, because to me,
even at age 7, which cracks me up.
Yeah, I know. I couldn't take it back then. But I mean, the truth is that, you know, older and wiser, you suspend disbelief, and the rest of the movie is you can see why it's a classic. And I sometimes wonder the whole tropes thing. It's like, oh yeah, it's a bit cringy, or it's become. It's like, was that because future movies and, you know, TV series took a lot of their cues from the Poseidon Adventure? I sort of wonder whether or not that's why we see it sometimes in that way, some parts of it. But I was surprised personally, just towards like the middle and the end of the movie, how invested I'd actually become in some of the characters. Because the acting really was quite good. There were some cringy bits, of course, and lots and lots of shouting. But it was it was.
My brother has beautiful hair.
He did once. That's certainly true. But yeah, I guess for me, I know that the odds of whether or not that could actually happen, the complete inversion thing, is pretty much zero. it land on its side? Sure, absolutely. Mm-hmm. Capsized, yes, but fully capsized like that? No. The center of buoyancy, it wouldn't work like that. You'd blow out the portholes on the side and it would just flood in from the side first and it would just tip over and sink sideways. But in the end, once you put your head in that space, if everything's upside down, like going up the stairwell upside down, that was the one that threw me, Steve, mm-hmm. when you mentioned how getting your head around that upside down, it's like, oh yeah, I guess that would be a smooth surface. So how would you get up there sort of thing? Mm-hmm. And that sort of, it challenges your thinking, and it's unique in that respect. And I kind of love that about it. So, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Anyway, well, I'm glad that you enjoyed it. I'm glad that everybody had a good time and is not mutinying on the podcast for me suggesting that this would make a good episode of The Incomparable. I like these 50 anniversaries because they are right now we're in that period of when I was a preteen to young teen, and the, you know, movies make an impact on your psyche. And this one definitely did. I didn't ever go on a cruise ship. I had actually already been a Titanic like buff as a little kid because I saw it in the encyclopedia under T, and I saw the little engraving picture, and I'm like, oh no, that's terrible.
It's and actually then, under the ocean. But anyway.
Yeah. So
that I looked it up under iceberg.
Yeah, a lot that I learned, I had to unlearn from what I'd learned from the encyclopedia. I seeing Poseidon and, you know, it's like, oh my gosh, ships, they're just so unreliable. And I never went on a cruise until I was 40, almost 50. And I was nervous. I was definitely like, okay, I hope I don't freak out and have like some kind of big panic attack because now it's happening.
Were you looking around for ways that you could move around the ship if it was upside down? I
did. Yeah, well, it was a
shouty people to follow in case you got in trouble.
Wow, that guy's really shouty.
It was a, it was a Mac geek cruise. So we mostly stayed inside sitting on our Macs.
Oh like God, a bunch of geeks arguing on trying to get out of the ship. Can you imagine? Yeah.
I think that would make an interesting one, but yeah, and we were in, we did go to Greece. So I was
you're just asking for it.
I know, right. But I discovered I really enjoy ships and I enjoy being on them. And, I do like it. So I got over it. Only took almost 50 years, or 40 years, but I got over it. But to me, yeah, it was completely etched in my brain, the movie. And I consider it one of my favorites if I want to feel a little bit scared. So, anyway, so I'm going to wrap this up and say thanks again to Annette, Steve, Shelley, and John for joining me on this not a 3-hour cruise. And I thank you to our listeners for coming along.